Today's date is August 29th, 1997. The speaker is Peter Cohen. The topic is Ugly Ducklings, Beautiful Spaces in Modern Buildings.
My name is Peter Cohen. I'm an architect in Seattle. I also teach architecture at the University of Washington. I've been coming up to Holden for many years, mostly in the capacity of one of the potters. This is the first time, and also for the last 15 years, just as a guest with my family. This is the first time I've been asked to be on teaching staff. And when Nancy asked me up, it was quite a challenge to try and figure out exactly what I wanted to do. In the Department of Architecture at the university, of course, I teach architecture to architectural students, and I've never taught to non-architectural students before. So it's been quite a challenge, but also quite an experience for me because it's forced me to really think about some basic ideas of architecture, what I think it is, what I think it does, and how we can make better architecture. What I'll do today is I'll talk a little bit in general about some of those things, and then I want to show you some buildings, some very common buildings, and then some more exalted buildings. I guess the main course is a beautiful chapel that I'm going to show you that was recently built up in the Swiss Alps. But before I begin, I'd like to set the stage by talking about some everyday objects that I went around my house and gathered before coming up here. They're objects that, for some reason, appealed to me. They're objects that have been used a lot around our household, and we tend to take for granted when we use them. But occasionally we'll pick them up and look at them and admire the way they're built and the way that they work and the materials of which they're made. So I think it's a good analogy. It's a very similar thing to architecture. The design profession, you can really think about architecture as designing things as small as spoons to all the way up to designing communities. Maybe these slides are a good example of that. This is a spoon that we picked up shortly after we were married, and it's Japanese. It's made actually out of a big diameter piece of bamboo, and you can see that this surface of the spoon is actually the outside surface of the bamboo. And if you look at the part on the back side of the flat part, you'll actually see the concave surface that actually represents the inside of that same layer. It's very quickly made. It's just cut and shaped. It reveals what it is. It's made out of a single material, and you can still begin to see that material in its making. Yet it's highly functional and has lasted, as I said, in our kitchen for 20 years. I love this spoon. So I'm just going to pass these around. I want to juxtapose that with a much more technological object, but in some ways very similar. These are some garden shears that I actually bought at Smith & Hawken. If that's wood, this will represent the use of metal. There are actually several ways that metal is used in these shears. The handles are cast aluminum, and they've been cast in such a way that they fit the hand. Look at the way the handle is twisted here, so that it actually fits your hand, the way this upper part of your hand, and then the lower portion of the handle has knobs to fit your fingers. There are other parts of this as well. There are the machined elements that actually allow it to go together. There are the blades, which have been forged out of a much harder steel, and that have been riveted onto the cast aluminum body. And obviously those hold a very sharp edge. Please be careful with these as you pass them around. And finally, there's the little spring, the little coil spring in the middle that's just a simple coiling of steel that allows them to spring back after you've used them. So there are different metals here that are employing different aspects of the potential of metal. First, the hardness and sharpness that it can acquire. Secondly, the malleability and the ability for it to be formed in a mold. And secondly, the ability for it actually to have a memory, it springs back to its original position. I don't do as much gardening as these kinds of shears would actually seem to ask for, but I love beautifully made objects, so maybe these will inspire me to do a little bit more gardening than I actually do. I also love the way then the handles have been dipped in rubber so that you have a nice soft grip. The last object is something that's much closer to home to me because it goes back to my history as a potter. It's a mug that I made when I was the village potter up here in 1979-80. There's nothing particularly special about this pot. The reason that I like it so much is because it's so unspecial. It was really made while I was in the midst of producing hundreds and hundreds of mugs, so it's very quickly thrown, the handle is very quickly pulled, but it reveals a lot about clay and the making and the malleability of this material just by virtue of what it is. If you look at it carefully, you can see the ridges that are formed because it's pulled very quickly up from the clay of which it's made, and so the fingers have left ridges which have been emphasized by the glaze. This glaze actually was made from some ashes from the fireplaces around here. But the glaze pools in the valleys of the ridges and then breaks to thinner areas at the peaks of the ridges, and so it reveals that texture even more. I've come to start putting a little ridge on my pottery here to create a greater sense of strength when I push the handle on and then pull the handle right on the body of the cup. And rather than waste any time smoothing the handle into the cup, there's a little stamp that I've always used to sort of just stamp it right into the body. If you look at the bottom, you'll see that I use a braided wire to cut it off of the lump of clay from which these are thrown, because I'll throw 8 to 10 mugs on a single lump of clay. And that braided wire actually leaves a pattern on the bottom of the cup. There was really not any conscious effort that went into the making of this pottery. It came from years and years of experience in working with clay and a certain body memory, I think, just a certain understanding of eventually your fingers as you work the material. And I think all of these objects that I'm passing around really exhibit that sense of a real careful and clear and deep understanding of the material of which they're made. And that's actually why I'm passing them around, and it's a preface for some of the things I'd like to talk about with regard to buildings. Before I do that, I left a little bit of unfinished business on Thursday, and so I'm going to give people a chance, if they'd like to talk about a room. I started out yesterday by showing some rooms that had been important to me, that were special for one reason or another, or that stuck in my memory. And oftentimes it has to do with personal memories. For instance, I showed the room that we first lived in, a little teeny room in the attic of an apartment building in Paris when we were first married. I also showed one of the former pot shops of Holden Village when it was in a beautiful room in Narnia in the wintertime. I think a room is the smallest significant experiential space that we can sort of break architecture down into. So one more example of a room to set this idea in motion is actually a window. This is Gripsholm Castle, which is outside of Stockholm. I don't know if any of you have been there. But like all castles, it has very, very thick walls. And in one of the great assembly halls in Gripsholm Castle, all of the windows and the window wells themselves have been turned into rooms. And you can see that on the right-hand slide. The cut through the brick masonry walls is much bigger than it needs to be. And so what happens is it's slightly splayed. And the reason for the splaying is to allow more light to reflect off of the sides and into the room. But also, there are benches on either side. And this creates, you can imagine, the thoughts, the kind of imaginary stories you can begin to develop around this space, there's a big banquet going on, or a big celebration in the large hall, and then these private little conversations occurring in these little window wells that become places for secrets to be told and other intimacies. And so this is one of my favorite rooms, and it's also a window well. I'm wondering if any of you actually did think over the night, or if you have any rooms that are important to you. Any memories of spaces that for some reason have moved you in some way or another?
The UN prayer room.
The UN prayer room?
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to describe it?
You enter from the back small door off left. You walk into a triangular room that maybe is about 15 to 20 feet at the back end, which narrows down to about maybe 8 to 10 feet in front, and there is a large black, I'm not quite sure what the word is for, it's an altar stone, but it's just a black oblong stone that's in the middle.
Monolith.
There are a few things that are draped in a few places. At the back, there are a couple of weaved mats out of some kind of organic material. And then there are a couple of very plain, either kneeling or sitting, sort of across and then down across.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the room. Mm-hmm. And there are a few places that I felt like the prayers of the entire world are gathered for the kind of hopes and dreams that they wish to be fulfilled for everyone.
So part of the meaning of that room is where it is, and the memories that room carries of people of different races and religions worshiping there together or by themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. How's the room lit?
My recollection is it feels like, in my memory, mm-hmm. indirect lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Very soft, gentle, but you can see everything in it, mm-hmm. so it's not dark.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a very small room compared with the very large rooms of the meeting rooms at the United Nations. And it's off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
You actually have to get permission to go into it. And it's right across.
Doesn't seem right.
Its entrance is right across from Marc Chagall's beautiful, I don't know if it was I don't think it's a painting, I think it's a stained glass.
Oh, yeah.
And so you go from this gorgeous, rich, beautiful color outside to very plain, very simple,
and
very
so you go into this
centered space.
Quiet, calm room that seems right for contemplation and meditation.
Yes.
And prayer. Anybody else? Okay. Carrying on with the notion of well-made objects, I want to talk about simple buildings and how the details of buildings can really weave a tale that's much more complex, perhaps, or much more interesting than just the building itself. Mies van der Rohe is credited with saying God is in the details, which is part of the title of my talk. It's actually not original to Mies van der Rohe. It can be traced way farther back in history than that, but at least among architectural circles, it's ascribed to Mies. Mies van der Rohe has an interesting place in architectural history because I think he made really beautiful buildings. They're quite austere, they're quite simple, but they're exquisitely detailed, and they're the kind of buildings that you actually have to go to, I think, understand fully. Unfortunately, he is also considered to be the father of the international style. I think many of his disciples and disciples of disciples didn't really understand the careful craftsmanship that was required for simple buildings, and so he's credited with some of the worst or being responsible for some of the worst architecture that we've had in the last 40 years. which is, I think, a shame. But in any case, I think the details of buildings are very important. And these are two door handles that I actually showed. I talked about these two buildings yesterday, and I'm not going to talk about them today. But I think that details are the smallest unit of signification in a building. That the smallest element that can begin to tell the story of a building, or the story of a people, or the story of a culture. And they're particularly important, as I said, with very simple buildings. So to kind of set that up, there's an article that's very good for architecture students. I think it might be a little bit too arcane, too technical for a lay audience, but it's by Marco Frascari called The Tell the Tale Detail. And he talks about the detail being the point. He talks about building technology, and then he breaks apart technology, techni, and logos. And he said the detail is where the techni of logos and the logos of techni come together, which mean construction and construing, making and meaning. And I think that that's really true in the case of a lot of good buildings. So here are two door handles that obviously are about buildings that tell two very different stories. This, for your information, these are the door handles on the Stockholm Public Library, which was built in 1925, designed by Gunnar Ostlund. And these are the handles on the new St. Ignatius Chapel at Seattle University, designed by Stephen Hall. So, architecture. Let me do a little Frascari thing and break down the word. Actually, the earliest root of architect can be traced to Sanskrit, toxon, which means use of the axe. And then if you take it to Greek, architect means master builder or master carpenter. And it referred primarily to begin with working with wood, although it has come to mean working with any material, but you can see how closely tied it is to craft. It's not master designer or master supervisor or master artist, it's master carpenter. And again, sort of going back to the roots of architecture, I think a lot of the buildings that we like in vernacular traditions, we like them because they're well crafted. There's another meaning that's been ascribed to the word tecton, and it actually comes from Sappho. I looked in the Holden Library. Unfortunately, the Holden Library is a little light on poetry by Sappho, but she was a Greek poet who lived on the Isle of Lesbos, and we have some of her poetry. The one that I know, the only one line that I know from Sappho, and I know it is because it was the title of a J.D. Salinger story, and it starts, "Raise high the roof beams." But Sappho actually described the act of poetry as tecton, so she kind of called the tecton as a poet. And I really like that because I like to think of the architect as being kind of the poet carpenter or the poet builder. I think that actually comes the closest to what I think that perhaps architects really ought to do. So we have this idea of architects as builder poets, and why should architects be poets? Well, I think that gets back to some ideas that I talked about yesterday as well, and that has to do with what architecture does in our society. How does architecture affect our perception of the world? And if you'll excuse me for being a little bit, I don't know, maybe this is not the right thing to do, but I'm going to read. Martin Heidegger was fascinated with architecture, and he never really wrote about architecture, but he used architecture as an example for a lot of things he was trying to describe in his philosophy. And he wrote a piece called The Origin of a Work of Art, in which he describes a building in its relationship to the landscape. And I think it describes fairly accurately what architecture can do or does. So this will be very brief. A building, I don't have a Greek temple, by the way. He's talking about a Greek temple, but you can almost imagine that this is in the Swedish archipelago outside of Stockholm, and every inhabitable rock will have a little summer stuga on it. And so here is this one person's little stuga. And you can almost imagine that it's a little Greek temple out there. So the best I can do. This is a castle in Savonlinna in Finland, and I think you'll see why I've got that up there now, too. A building, a Greek temple, portrays nothing. It simply stands there in the middle of the rock-cleft valley. The building encloses the figure of the god, and in this concealment lets it stand out in the holy precinct through the open portico. By means of the temple, the god is present. This presence of a god is in itself the extension and delimitation of the precinct as a holy precinct. The temple and its precinct, however, do not fade away into the indefinite. It is the temple work that first fits together and at the same time gathers around itself the unity of those paths and relations in which birth and death, disaster and blessing, victory and disgrace, endurance and decline acquire the shape of destiny for human being. So I think what Heidegger is saying there is that architecture really begins to define and describe a context for human activity. A little further on, he goes on to say, he repeats standing there, or the building stands there, about four times in this article. So that's obviously very important to him, just kind of the notion of this building up against the landscape. Standing there, the building rests on the rocky ground. This resting of the work draws up out of the rock the mystery of that rock's clumsy yet spontaneous support. Standing there, the building holds its ground against the storm raging above it, and so first makes the storm itself manifest in its violence. The luster and gleam of the stone, though itself apparently glowing only by the grace of the sun, yet first brings to light the light of the day, the breadth of the sky, the darkness of the night. The temple's firm towering makes visible the invisible space of air. The steadfastness of the work contrasts with the surge of the surf, and its own repose brings out the raging of the sea. So in that portion, he's talking about how it also defines and describes the world around us in contrast. And I guess what I would say about architecture is that architecture conveys meaning whether we like it to or not. And so oftentimes we just let architecture convey meaning without thinking about it, and that's probably a mistake. And if you look at modern architecture and the buildings that we've built in the last 50 years, the vast majority of them, you can see the kind of legacy that we've actually left for our forebears. Or forebears, is that right? The right word? One more little delving into a little bit of architectural theory, and then I'll move on to some buildings. Mid-19th century, there was an architect named Gottfried Semper, and if you know anything about architectural history, you know that in the 19th century, there were all kinds of revivalist movements. He, in particular, was a classicist, a neoclassicist, and most of the buildings that he designed were Greek revivalist in nature. And he began to look at the history of architecture and how it had always been classified according to chronology, that we had Egyptian architecture and Greek architecture and Roman architecture and medieval architecture and Gothic architecture. And he began to, I think maybe he was worried about his own place in history and the fact that that architecture seemed to be repeating itself, and maybe he was trying to diminish the importance of chronology in history, and that something new had to be created every 100 years. But in any case, he was dissatisfied with the way we looked at architecture. He had a very good friend who was an eminent biologist named George Cuvier, who was a rival of Darwin's, I believe, who was developing a means of classifying flora and fauna by their physical characteristics. And so he started looking at buildings. He went to the Great Exhibition in the Crystal Palace, 1851 in London, and he saw this Caribbean hut from some Caribbean natives. And he looked at it and he decided that this simple building contained all of the basic elements of architecture, and that we could really start to classify and describe architecture just of the materials of which it's made and how they go together. And he saw that the center of this building was the hearth, And the hearth actually has physical presence. It's the fireplace. But also, the hearth for him came to mean this sort of cultural embodiment that exists in every building. Then there are certain more physical elements. There's the earthwork from which the building rises out of the ground. And Heidegger refers to the importance of the way a building meets the ground. And there's the roof, which shelters the building up against the sky and the supporting columns, which hold the roof up. And that's the way that the building meets the sky. And we had that within Heidegger, too, about the building against the raging storms. And finally, there's some way of enclosing the building in cladding. Semper actually decided that the cladding was the earliest of architectural elements because that really comes from clothing. In any case, he started to look at buildings and see how every building could be classified that way. And every building has earthwork. Somehow it has to rise out of the ground, and you can't use lightweight materials to do that. So there's always a base to the building that's very important. And then above that base, there's another kind of architecture that takes place, usually for the purpose of holding up the roof. And that roof-like element somehow is silhouetted against the sky and becomes a very important figure, too. And so here you can see in these, this little, this is actually a marketplace in Charleston, South Carolina. The front of the marketplace, and here's an early, some early buildings in southern Finland with side roofs. And you can see those elements at play here. So, where are we? Yeah. Okay, now we're going to talk about what I want to talk about. And that's modern, that's the several notions that I think are derived from vernacular architecture. And that is that we like buildings that are simple, they're easy to understand, we can comprehend them by looking at them. And we like buildings that are well made. We like to see the way a building goes together, how that goes together, and the craftsmanship and the joints, the details. I think that's what attracts us so much to vernacular buildings, and I think that's why we don't like so many modern buildings. They're too complex, they're made out of too many materials. Those materials don't really reveal what they are, what their inherent qualities are, and how they're worked. And so I think we need to go back to some of the principles that originally governed the building of buildings like these. Now, we can't go back in terms of materials that we use or the craftsmanship that's required to build them. The perfect example is in church architecture. We would all love to build a Gothic cathedral again, but it's impossible. We don't have the virtually slave labor, they weren't slaves, but the incredibly poorly compensated laborers that allowed those beautiful things to be built. And we don't have the time or the technology to build that way anymore, the masonry that's required. And so we have to look at new materials and new ways of doing things. I'm not implying that architecture looked to the past in terms of materials or forms, but architecture looked to the past in terms of the simplicity of buildings and the way they dealt with materials. So, I'm going to show you some buildings. This is actually two slides, but I think it sets up what I want to talk about. And again, it's very Semperian in the notion of the base that meets the ground, the masonry, which actually rises up and becomes part of the walls. And then the carpentry up above, the tectonics, which actually allows the building to meet the sky and brings the light into the building. This is a chapel at Otaniemi University in Finland. And you can see how simple it is. It's a square box with brick walls that rise up about 10 feet, a brick floor, and a little cap made of wooden trusses and wooden clad roof above that brings light in from one side. It's really interesting. The top brings the light in from the, I'm not sure what the direction is, but But then the other end, in the brick portion, the lower portion, it's all open, and the cross itself is actually out in the woods. So I think this is a good preface to some of the buildings that I'm going to show you a little bit more of. I'm going to start with a truck garage. This is not an ordinary truck garage, however. This is a railway depot just south of Oslo. And it has a huge truck that really is a gigantic forklift that lifts containers off of trains and puts them down onto the ground where a semi can hook onto it and take off. And they needed a shelter for this truck. They also needed a place to pull an engine if they could. It's a 42-ton truck. I think the engines are like... The crane, I think, can actually pull out about 15 tons. And they needed a place to be able to work on it. It didn't have to be insulated, but it had to be protected from the elements. It was in the midst of a pastoral agrarian setting. And one of the problems with the architect, it was designed by a young employee of the Norwegian State Railway System. The budget wasn't huge. But one of the problems was actually how to put such a gigantic building in this landscape and not make it look terrible. And so I think that is one of the reasons that Jan Olaf Jensen actually decided on this round form. There are others as well. But you can see how it fits in, the siding as well. It almost looks like some kind of a truncated grain silo. There are some other buildings as well. You can see the railway line going by. I don't have a picture of the truck, unfortunately. It's an extraordinary simple building. It has gigantic doors that swing out wide to move the truck in and out, and that's what the reason the steel frame extends out beyond the form. Another reason for the steel frame extending out beyond the form, of course, is to provide some moment resistance so that the building doesn't want to tip over in the wind, and that's why it has cross bracing on the wings and then also on the inside. It's a steel framed building with a curved cladding around the outside of it. I think one of the reasons for the curved cladding is also for it to resist and deflect wind loads. But actually, a building that's this tall out in the open would be subject to a lot of wind forces, but when you curve the walls like that, it allows it to withstand it much better. The doors slide open. I'm told, this is a building I've not been to, but I'm told the doors slide open with almost the push of the finger. The inside is really quite marvelous. It's a steel frame that is clad solid on the top, and then the roof slopes down towards the center. There's no drain for it. It just comes running off of the peak here, and there's a little drain down below here. But in order to bring light into the structure, Jan Olaf Jensen decided to not mess with the basic frame and roof, but to bring light in the space between the enclosing walls and the primary structure itself. And so all around the rectangular steel frame is this curved wall. The curved wall actually attaches to the steel frame in a way that allows it to rotate as it wraps around. It's attached to you know what a steel beam looks like. It's got two flanges on the top and a cord in the middle. There's a little piece of steel that goes into the side of the flange to which this wooden structure is attached, and it allows it to rotate at any angle. And so these wooden columns are square with the curve of the walls as it moves around. And then on top of that are rested just clear plexiglass panels, and that brings this incredible light in through the space. Everything is revealed. As I said, one of the nice things about uninsulated buildings is it makes it a lot easier to show the way the building is built and really rely on that for a lot of the power of the building. Another interesting thing is that he was able to economize on materials because this wall is curved. If you imagine a wooden board, it acquires much more strength when you bend it. It actually, when it's put in tension, it's much stronger against those wind forces, but it's actually able to span farther. And so he was able to reduce the number of vertical elements. They're only at 6 feet apart because the wood has that much more strength when it's in tension. Another thing about a column is that it really doesn't need to be as wide as most columns are. Most columns aren't as wide as they are because of gravity loads coming down on them, but they're as wide as they are because of lateral forces. In other words, if columns didn't want to bend, they would take a huge amount of load, just vertical load on their tops. And so ideally, so at the tops and the bottoms where a column doesn't want to bend, it doesn't need to be as fat as it does in the middle. So actually the ideal shape for a column would be something like this, tapered to be fatter in the middle. Well, these are little glue land columns, and Jan Olof Jensen didn't really want to mess with that. But what he did do to show that was at the tops and the bottoms, actually, each of these columns is notched. Because to carry the gravity load, it only needs to be that big. But in order to take the wind load and the bending, it needs to be fatter in the center. A very inexpensive building, very quickly made. You can see there's not a great deal of time taken in the formwork. It's fairly rough, but the details are all just beautifully expressive of what's going on, the way the cross spacing comes through the column is revealed on this side. I particularly like the way the cross bracing all comes together to this cast steel ring in the center of it. So, one of the reasons I show this slide is that I think that everything we do, it's important to design carefully. I often think of the act of building as one of the highest of human activities, and it's an act of creation and reflects our own creation and therefore is an important act. The next building I'm going to show you, and I'm going from the sublime to the ridiculous, from a truck garage to a bathroom. This is, some of you may have been here or some of you may not have an opportunity to go. This is at Washington Pass on the North Cascades Highway. If any of you have been there a half a dozen years ago, it's a fairly major rest stop on a very scenic highway. So there's a lot of traffic. There's also a beautiful overlook. If you go take a little path this way, there's a beautiful view of Liberty Bell Mountain, which appears on just about every Washington State calendar that's ever been made. But in any case, if you were there 6 years ago, or 5 years ago, or even 4 years ago, you'll know that there were a series of really stinky outhouses there. And a couple of forest rangers thought that something better should happen at Washington Pass. And they also wanted to build an interpretive center there to commemorate Northwest climbing. And so they persuaded the Forest Service to commission this building. The entire building, oftentimes when I show these pictures, people can't believe you would spend so much money for a restroom, so it helps to set it in context. Although it's not built yet, the restroom building, which is actually part of a larger complex. And this will ultimately be the interpretive center, which will, as I say, be dedicated to Northwest Mountaineering. And the path that leads out to Liberty Bell Mountain is this one right here. The parking, which is considerable, attempts to be nested in these trees. There's so much of it that it doesn't work as well as it could. But then the notion is that people gather on this path and finally follow it out to the interpretive center and then out another 100 yards to this spectacular view. But what we have is the restroom building right now. And I think it does a lot of the things that good buildings should do. First of all, it sits in its landscape. It rises up out of the ground in the fashion that a building should do. What you see first as you pull in are these rock walls, which seem to come right out of the rock that's in the earth. But at the same time, you begin to understand that there's a building here. It's not just a rock wall, but there are these concrete columns which appear to be holding up the structure itself. as you park your car and you come around, you can also see more details of the concrete frame of the building, the big glue lamps that hold up the roof, and that there's obviously habitable space within. I've included this slide because it really reveals the construction more. You can see the great roof that's going on. There's a 375 pound per square foot snow load at Washington Pass. The North Cascades Highway is actually closed from about November to about June or July. People never really see the snow, but one of my contentions is that this great roof really provides a memory of the 12 feet of snow that sat on its roof all winter long when you arrived there. So this slide actually reveals that it's really a concrete wall that's clad in stone, and that's why the stone is actually revealed, to not deceive, to not make people think that this is an old building that was built a long time ago purely of stone, but that because of modern building practice and seismic requirements, that this is actually a concrete building. You slowly move around to the path. Someday the path will all be this slate, but right now it's largely asphalt. And you begin to see that the building first starts out as two great walls. One high wall that sits, that faces south, that in which the building is nestled, and one low wall which forms a precinct, this slate platform, and all kinds of activities take place here. People eat lunch here, people just gather before they go out to the view, or when they come back, they sit and eat their lunches. And so here you can begin to see the building itself. The building is formed by gigantic glue lamp beams which rest on the back wall and then are supported on the front wall by these tapered columns. And here again is that expression of the physical forces of gravity and how the properties of wood react to that. It has to be thicker in the center to resist buckling, but it can actually become quite narrow at the top and the bottom where we don't have to worry about that and it's only gravity loads that are being accepted. The roof itself, as I mentioned, is a real expression of the incredibly huge snow loads that rest on this building. It's a memory because people really never see it. But the snow rests on a roof that consists of tongue and groove decking on top of 4x4 sub-purlins on top of 8x8 glue lamp purlins. And you can see the glue lamp purlins only go from one beam to the next. And the next purlin sits behind it, and then it comes out and back again. So it sets up this marvelous weaving pattern of this roof. Finally, gigantic paired glue lamp beams that are supported by these columns. Even the connections themselves are expressed. And again, it's an expression of structural forces. Most buildings that are held up on columns are what's known as pin connections. In other words, lateral forces are, it's very difficult to make a stiff enough joint in a frame to resist lateral forces. So another way is found, usually in the walls, to accept lateral forces. And most column beam connections are designed as a pin connection. In other words, they don't accept any of that lateral movement. They could just as easily be pinned. And so in this case, the joints are actually expressed as pins. They are gigantic pins. There's obviously not any movement that goes on there, or very little movement. But that notion of the structural principles at play in this building are expressed in the joints themselves. And there you can see them. Oh, another little interesting little side light. Most of the metal is galvanized because that's the easiest way to treat steel to give it some weatherproofing. However, galvanized surface does come off. It can be scraped off. It's not as permanent as other things. And so where movement might occur in the bolt itself, it's actually a stainless bolt and nut, because that is resistant to any kind of removal of that corrosion-resistant surface. The doors are slid shut in the wintertime, so there are these gigantic metal-clad doors that slide across the openings when the restroom building is closed off in the wintertime. And then the walls themselves are made out of cedar, a shiplap siding, wide and narrow. And even here, the joining is expressed, so screws are used. There's a special square-headed driver that's used for these screws. It was worried that the only people that can get up here in the wintertime are snowmobilers. And there was some concern that they might actually start to take apart this building. So it was decided to use a square-headed driver so that it wasn't likely that a snowmobiler had one of those in their toolkit. The joints are also an opportunity to express the material. So rather than putting corner boards on the joints or mitering the corners, both of which have problems, mitering the corners causes problems because any of you who have mitered corners on siding know that it tends to open up after time. And so rather than allow that to happen, the siding is just terminated almost in a log cabin fashion, with one end being exposed on one course and the next end being exposed on the other course. There was a lot of end grain exposed already on this building on the beams up above, so that it was felt that the best way to deal with that was just by treating it every now and then. I'm going to get you inside this building pretty soon, but really it's more about the outside than the inside anyway. The entries to the bathrooms are from the middle and from the ends. The reason for that is somewhat complicated, but basically what happens is they wanted to use composting toilets, but there's too much volume up here. So during certain parts of the year where there isn't so much volume, the middle bathrooms are open. Those contain composting toilets. But when the volume really increases and they need to serve a lot more people, they open up two additional bathrooms on the ends that have what are known as micro flush toilets. They use water, but they use much less water. In any case, here you can see the end of that wall there. You can see how the concrete wall is revealed inside. It's not as though the stone wraps around the corner, but it's almost as though the wall is just chopped off so that you can see its construction. And then as the wall moves into the bathroom, it actually, the rock cladding is left off entirely and just moves in as the concrete wall. Here you can see, even on the side doors, these little walls that are slid shut during the wintertime. On the inside, obviously, one of the big problems with public restrooms is vandals. And so everything is clad in steel. It's treated in a similar fashion to the siding outside. All the fasteners are exposed, and two different kinds of steel are used. The traditional brushed stainless that you see in virtually every public restroom fixture. And then a different kind of finish, it's called a 2B finish, is used on the walls in order to create a little bit of texture and a little bit of difference between the two. When you're inside, of course, you can look up still and see all the mountains and the trees around you. It's almost as though this lower wall is freestanding. And then I think if possible, this would have been left totally open and you just would have had this privacy wall and then the great roof above protecting you from the snow and then the view out from over the top of that wall.
Peter, yeah. Are those metal walls, they can't do graffiti on them?
They can, but it can be buffed off. Basically, there's nothing to prevent anybody. There's no kind of wall that can prevent graffiti. In any case, I think it's an extravagant building. It's particularly extravagant for a restroom building. In the context of the museum to come, I think it's actually appropriate. And in the context of building a building in this incredibly harsh climate, and a building that one hopes would last virtually forever, I think it's the kind of buildings we should be making. There's a lot of talk, there was a lot of consideration in this building about the way materials were used, and particular materials, whether or not they should be used. And I think the attitude that was established here, at least, was, yes, we have to be extraordinarily careful with the building resources that we have, but the first thing is to build well. And if we build well, we won't have to build again. Okay. This is a little chapel in this, what is the name of the mountains? Let me see this one. Some of you may have been there. The Surselva Mountains in Switzerland. Is there any Swiss, anybody know Switzerland at all? Anyway, it's way up in the mountains. This little village had a chapel made of stone, like many of the traditional chapels were, that was wiped away by an avalanche. And so they decided to rebuild. They found an architect whose name is Peter Zumthor, and they said, we want to build it ourselves. And so that actually limited the materials with which the architect could work. They weren't very skilled masons, but they were quite skilled at wooden architecture. And so, contrary to tradition, it was decided that this building should be made of wood. Here you can see this amazing context. This is a little edge of the building that we're going to look at, and it sits up above the village. So you're actually going to have to hike up to come to this chapel. You can see how the village itself just follows this mountain road. And then this little teardrop shape right here thing is the chapel itself. And there's a trail that leads up to it from, I guess, what could be called the center of town, and up to the chapel. And then finally, it leads through the Alps to another village. As you look up from the town, it looks like a gigantic, well, what does it look like? Like a silo. I think it looks like a silo. If you don't think about the materials, it also looks like a big castle tower, I think. There are a lot of connotations that you can make, but it really has a strong presence up against the mountain. One of the things I like about it is the way it meets the ground, and this gets back to what I talked about initially. Rather than having it just drop right down, the foundation drop right down into the ground, the concrete foundation actually has a shoulder. It tapers off into the ground, and so it's very much like that castle that I showed you, that castle tower that seemed to rise up out of the rock. This too has that almost gentle curve that seems to imply that in some ways this is just rising up right out of the ground. As you take the trail up and around the side, you can begin to see the entry and the bell tower. The bell tower, I'm told, refers to Jacob's ladder, which reaches up into heaven. This ladder obviously is impossible to climb, but as you move up, the sides come closer together, and the steps, if you would like to call them that, also become closer and closer together. So maybe that almost brings heaven a little bit closer to the earth that way. I hope I'm going to have a better picture of the steps. Yeah. What, another thing that I think is really interesting about this building is the way that you enter it. It sits on the side of the hill, and rather than try and somehow penetrate directly into this pure teardrop form, a little vestibule is added off to the side, almost as though it kind of spins off. And leading up to that vestibule are a set of heavy cast concrete steps, an extraordinary simple steel rail. What happens right here, though, is especially interesting. The steps aren't connected to the building. If the building went away, the steps would be intact all by themselves. There's a little bit of a space there that occurs, maybe an inch or two, and actually a little bit of a step as well. So it's almost as though you're leaving the earth when you step off these concrete steps. You literally leave something and step onto something else. Here's a detail of the door and the rail and the door handle. I love door handles. I think they're one of the best opportunities for architectural expression. And then you move into this small vestibule. Here you can see that door handle again. You can see how small it is. And you're still not inside the church. You're in this tiny vestibule. And you can see that even the structure of the church hasn't been interrupted for this vestibule. In other words, it stays pure. The cladding is peeled off, but the structure remains intact. And what do you see? You see this extraordinary roof and these columns that reach up to hold it. It's set apart from the rest of the building by the fact that it's entirely surrounded by skylights. But where you might expect to see a view, here you are. Remember that first slide I showed you? You're in a totally self-contained world. The walls, this is not an expensive building either, although it's finely crafted. The walls are plywood. They've been painted with silver paint. And so they start to blend with the sky up above. You never actually even see much of the sky because, as you can see over here, there are little plywood fins that filter the light down into this building. I like to think that you've somehow, there are a lot of different interpretations of this building. One is that it seems somehow like an ark, like it's the Noah's Ark that's finally crashed on Mount Ararat. The way that you actually leave the ground to enter this building, though, I almost think like it's some kind of a heavenly kingdom that you finally enter. And so you do it twice. You have to step off the concrete platform to get into the vestibule, and then you have to step up one more time onto the floor of the chapel. It's not over yet. The chapel floor actually slopes very slightly towards the center, so there's another boat-like metaphor as you step into this space. It gradually tapers this way. You can see it's very, very simple. You'll see in a moment, I'll show you, there's a little cabinet for the vestments and the stuff that goes on the altar. An extraordinarily simple altar and a small icon, and that's about it. Even the light fixtures themselves are very simple. This is looking at that same entry vestibule and door from inside, looking back. It's a project that's all about this very ephemeral space on the one hand, yet at the same time, it's talking amazingly clearly about materials. Look at the way the columns are separated from the walls. They're held off the walls by these little metal, little steel bolts. I don't think I included a wall section, but these are regular insulated walls that are held apart from the columns that are holding off the roof. So everything is very highly and clearly articulated. I apologize for this slide. I realized I didn't have a slide looking at the altar itself, and so this is a slide that comes from a picture that's about 2 inches square. So that's why it's so grainy. But that does give you a shot looking at the altar and then looking back the other way. Here's the entry. Here's where all of the required things are stored that need to be here. And you can see the beautiful cabinets that fit right in within the framing of the building again. The furniture is extraordinarily simple. It looks Shaker in a way. And then, of course, then the main thing that your attention is drawn to is this roof that's being supported by the columns and the light that filters into the windows. And this big spine, this big column that actually is the ridge beam, this big ridge beam is
like a keel almost.
It looks like a keel, yeah. I mean, there's nothing so much as an upturned boat that this looks like as well. So maybe we have two boats here. And then just a nice example of that detail, the way the fins are at the windows. The joinery isn't expressed. We don't really know how. I mean, all the joinery is obviously on the inside, the way these members come together. And I think it has to do with the absolute simplicity that was trying to be achieved in this building. Here's another shot of that back corner and the light that comes in. And you can imagine the way the light comes into this thing as well. Here you can really see fairly clearly the walls, the painted silver walls. Here it is in the wintertime. I love, well, the thing that I love most about this, and the thing that you're puzzled about first, is it's in this beautiful valley overlooking this amazing landscape, and you really can't see out of it. Well, the villagers live there all the time. They don't need to see the valley. And I think being transported into another world, you know, is really an amazing, I think that there's a, I think you would get goosebumps going into this place. That's my talk yesterday. Dwayne was in the audience, and he talked about getting goosebumps when going into a building, and I think that that's a really good description of what a building should do. So here it is on the inside and on the outside.
Do they use the basement at all, or is it just all?
No, it's just a one-room chapel.
Okay.
That's a one-room chapel. It's a very small village, and any kind of social activity that they might have would occur elsewhere. So it really is, it really is literally a house of God. You know, that's all it is.
A question on being practical, heating in the winter. Mm-hmm. I see no signs of anything.
Well, it actually is. It actually is a quite well-insulated building. But I should have included the detail. I wasn't sure that there was anybody that could really read them, but these are quite thick insulated walls. And the roof has exposed framing on the inside, but it also is heavily insulated between the framing and the metal roof. So this is actually a quite well insulated building. By the way, if you had a question about this, there actually is a little panel down below about 6 inches, so we're not worried about dogs and cats and children falling down into the basement of this building. But it actually is. This is a building that's in a quite harsh environment, and it's been, those concerns have been addressed really wonderfully, I think, and not allowed to interfere with this, you know, structure of the building.
How do they heat it?
I have no idea. I'm sure it's in the basement. There is a basement.
Yeah.
To this building.
Question: is the tip of the teardrop pointed up the mountain?
It is.
Is that in an attempt to blunt the force of any further avalanches coming?
Well, I've not been to this building. I've read that this building is actually, even though it looks like it's up precariously in the mountains, it's in a good location for that. It's in a place where it's not likely to be swept away by an avalanche. After one experience of that, the villagers certainly didn't want to have a second. However, that's what the shape comes from. Oftentimes in Switzerland, they'll build these wedges, usually out of stone, that are meant to divert avalanche forces. So there's definitely that illusion in the building. Yeah. I have one more building, but I'm a little bit, I think I'm going to let people go if they want to. As I looked at these buildings, they all seemed fairly, even though they're truck garages and bathrooms, they are special buildings. They're not everyday buildings. They're not the kind of building that we build with a typical client and we try and improve the overall grain of our environment.